Well, good evening, everybody. I'm Tony Giddens, the director of the LSE, at least for another few months, and very pleased to welcome you here and to welcome our distinguished speaker, Eileen Barker, on study of religion, one of the core fields of sociology, social sciences. All the classical sociologists, quite rightly, felt they were compelled to study it. I spent quite a part of my early intellectual career studying the classical sociologists Emil Durkheim and Max Weber, and of course both of those great writers made religion in many respects the center point of their work. Durkheim places emphasis on ritual, ceremonial, the church as sacred space, distinction between the sacred and the profane. Weber made religion the center of his massive study of world civilizations and drew these contrasts, which I think are still compelling today, between salvation religions of the West and the Near East and the exemplary religions of the Far East. Salvation religions having this energizing impetus of kind of juxtaposition of sin and redemption. But both these great classical sociologists made a mistake, because they both believed that religion would lose its importance with the further advance of modernity. I mean, Durkheim argued that, as he put it, there's something eternal in religion which will stay with us, but he thought the content of religion would itself become increasingly secularized. And in Weber's somewhat gnomic statements on these issues, he makes it pretty plain that he thought the influence of religion would progressively shrink with the advance of secularization. We know this has not happened, or if it has happened, it's happened only ambiguously. Religion, as we see from the conflict shaping up around us at the moment, still a major impact in societies through the world. And even if you look at this country, you have an extraordinary variety of religious organizations and religious sects, which Eileen has made the center of her writings and of her work with Inform. I even have written down here what Inform stands for: the Information Network Focus on Religious Movements. And a lot of extraordinary work has gone on in that. I remember when I first got to the LSE, it was only, I think, first few months, you took me to have a look at your files and extraordinary amount of information there is in there, and the extraordinary element of religiosity which goes on, you know, bubbles away in our society. Eileen Barker is Professor of Sociology with special reference to the study of religion in the LSE. Well, she is Professor in the LSE of Sociology with special reference to religion. She will be giving up at the LSE, I think, at about the same time as I do, and this lecture is one of her last star appearances. Eileen's research specialisms are the following. First, the study of alternative religions, particularly those commonly called cults or sects. Second, the fate of religion in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union since the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989. Thirdly, most recently, she has conducted a nationwide survey in Britain with the help of an ESRC grant, which is part of a pan-European project mysteriously called RAMP, investigating religious and moral pluralism. That's why it's called RAMP. Herewith follows a list of her honours. She has been awarded an OBE for her work with Inform. She is a fellow of the British Academy. She is the only non-American to have been elected president of the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion, and has just finished her first term as president of the Association for the Sociology of Religion. She was the 2001 recipient of the American Academy of Religion's prestigious Martin Marty Award for promotion of the understanding of religion. As you can see by the lecture hall, which is now completely full, religion still has a drawing power, and particularly Eileen still has massive drawing power. The title of her talk is Why, comma, for God's sake? So please give her a very, very warm welcome.
She said she was going to speak for 2.5 hours, but I told her she mustn't.
I don't have to now because Tony's given half my lecture. No one who's opened a newspaper or turned on the radio or switched on the television in the last few weeks or months can have failed to notice that there are an awful lot of people justifying what they're doing and advocating that others should perform certain acts for God's sake. This is nothing new. Some of the most compassionate and sacrificial acts and some of the most horrendous episodes of history have been carried out in God's name. Think of the atrocities perpetrated by the Crusades and by the Inquisition for God's sake. Recently we've witnessed, what is this? Is it me? Or is it the fire? Or is it for God's sake? Or, it stopped. Right. We've seen the work of Albert Schweitzer and Mother Teresa on the one hand, and the horrors of genocide and ethnic cleansing, which has more often been associated with religion than ethnicity, on the other hand. But even if what's been happening in Northern Ireland, Indonesia, the former Republic of Yugoslavia, Nagorno-Karabakh, Sudan, etc., or the Holy Land, for God's sake, even insofar as this has not been about religion, as much as perhaps about economic or political or territorial interests, the very fact that religious labels have been applied to the combatants has made and continues to make the confrontations considerably more intransigent. One might be able to negotiate the redistribution of a percentage of wealth, power, or land, but it's not so easy to become 4/5 Catholic and 1/5 Protestant. I'm not going to talk, however, about the impending war, nor about 9/11 or even Huntington's clash of civilizations, at least not directly. Everyone else seems to be doing that. I want rather to look at some aspects of religious change and diversity. And underlying the theme of this, there is another theme, and that is some of the ways in which concepts, definitions, and boundaries to which the change in diversity has given rise are being used and misused. Of course, we need concepts. They're necessary for the existence of human society. But despite frequent claims to the contrary, most, if not all, concepts are not God-given. Furthermore, that which is joined together and that which is rent asunder may be suggested, but it certainly isn't dictated by what is out there. To understand the processes by which concepts are produced, maintained, and changed, we need to look at the processes of society. There are various aspects of concepts that a sociologist of religion or any other social scientist might be interested in. First of all, this what is put in and what is excluded. What is a real religion or real Christianity or real Islam? Quite apart from theological considerations, there are quite a lot of secular consequences. If you're defined as a religion, you can get tax exemption. If you're not, you can't, for example. Then secondly, who does the defining? Is the concept of a real woman defined by the role models to be found in the Bible? On the one hand, we have evil Eve, who was responsible for the fall of man. And on the other hand, there's Mary, mother of Jesus, who, unlike most of us, however hard we may try, was both a virgin and a mother. Thirdly, how strongly are the boundaries of the concept drawn? Are they set in stone? Or are they more or less permeable? Are they more negotiable or more manipulable in some circumstances than in others? And if so, which are what? And fourthly, does the boundary reinforce or cross-cut other boundaries so that, for example, our identity and that of others is reduced to simple them-us dichotomies? Or do we have many different identities which connect us with different groups of people? Here, some of you will know the work of Mary Douglas, who makes the distinction between the strong group and what she calls the grid. I prefer the network. And this is where there are very strong dichotomies drawn between them and us. And associated with that, we have the ideas of godly and satanic, good, bad, natural, unnatural, evil, etc., etc. And everything fits up very nicely together. You can also get ideas of before and after, just to illustrate this dichotomous worldview, where there are sharp lines drawn. For example, what I'm calling the Armageddon lot, they will tend to think that their conversion to their group was one of the most important things that there were, that happened. This is what I call the bum to saint syndrome. Before, I was a miserable sinner, and then the Holy Ghost descended or something happened, and behold, I was converted, whereas my friend rejected it. I thereby became a saint, whereas he started to grow horns and a forked tail. Then the big transition will come, and I will be translated up to heaven, and he is burning for eternal damnation. There are various different ways in which this can be seen, and these distinctions can be made. But I just wanted to give the idea that this is a sort of outlook and worldview which is very clear-cut. You know where you are and what your primary identity is. And that's compared with the network, or what Mary Douglas calls the grid, where you have a whole lot of different identities. One may be with your church, another with your family of origin, another at the workplace, another at school, and so on. So there are these different ways in which the dichotomies are made. Now, it should be noticed that strong us boundaries don't necessarily lead to violence or even confrontation. There are plenty of groups with strong boundaries, the Amish or the Hutterites, who are perfectly peaceful. But it does quite often help to make people be more antagonistic if they do see the enemy and everybody else apart from themselves as them. And there's been quite a lot of work on suicide bombers and other people who aren't particularly religious zealots, and they're certainly not uneducated and pathetic people, but they have been brought to believe that them out there are dangerous and evil, and that something has to be done because of that through this worldview. And also we should recognize that very often there is a process going on between them and us, so that we can make matters worse in a number of ways and strengthen the boundary. For example, the FBI made it very easy for David Koresh to keep his Branch Davidians in Mount Carmel and Waco. By their behavior during the siege, the FBI's behavior, that is, they were proving to Koresh's followers the truth of the prophecies in the book of Revelation, and that the Battle of Armageddon was being fought. And there are plenty of other examples that we can find of what this is called by the criminologists as deviant amplification. Before going any further, I think I ought to make a point for those of you who are not social scientists, and perhaps for one or two of you who are. That is, we cannot use God as an independent variable. Very often when I meet somebody who has converted, I ask them why they converted to a particular religion, and the answer is, well, God spoke to me, or an angel visited me, and their parents are likely to say, well, it was satanic and it was the devil who got at them. And this, of course, is very difficult for the sociologist, because she or he has to reject the story that is given by the person themselves. However, God seems to be a bit of a sociologist, luckily, and he or she nearly always works through other people or some sort of institution or the cultural milieu, which means that we do have something that we can look at and investigate. And we can then discern certain regularities and patterns. Sounds as though something's going to explode, doesn't it? What is it? Is it dangerous? It's a hearing. Is it this? Oh, okay. Sorry about it. Oh, well, it's probably worse for you than it is for me. Anyway. There are those who have dismissed the sub-discipline of the sociology of religion because it said we live in an age of secularization. God is dead and religion irrelevant in the contemporary world. Now, I don't want to prolong what I think has become a somewhat sterile debate about the pros and cons of the secularization thesis. The protagonists are continually talking past each other in response to different questions and assuming different definitions. But from wherever one stands, I think possibly the most useful definition about secularization or of secularization remains that proposed by Brian Wilson in the mid-1960s. Secularization is the process whereby religious thinking, practice, and institutions lose social significance. It's the emphasis on the word social that encapsulates what the founding fathers of sociology were observing as they surveyed the scene in the 19th and early 20th century, pointing to a whole lot of isations that appear to take us beyond the religious worldview, as we've already heard. Indeed, it has been said by people like Weber and Merton that religion in the form of Protestantism was digging its own grave. The isations, industrialization, rationalization, urbanization, bureaucratization, modernization, and societalization have all played their part in undermining the great religious institutions of yesteryear. Structural and functional differentiation have resulted in the economy, welfare, education, health and the law and other public spheres being no longer dependent on religious values, practices or institutions for their operation. But that said, it needs to be stressed that even Wilson, who's widely acknowledged as the most doughty advocate of the secularization thesis today, doesn't suggest that this means religion has been disappearing altogether. Just, he says, that it's become more privatized. This means that people do their own thing to some extent, or at least they do not partake in the public religious behavior that was almost compulsory in the past. It's an alternative culture. It offers another world to explore as an escape, he says, from the rigors of technological order and the ennui that is the incidental byproduct of an increasingly programmed world. While it's undoubtedly true that many of the isations have taken their toll on institutional religion so far as the other institutions of modern societies are concerned, it's also true that other processes have been at work and have become increasingly visible over the last quarter or half century, and that many of these are playing a not insignificant role in the way we relate to each other in contemporary society at both the individual and the social level. As I said, the aspects of contemporary religion that I want to look at this evening are those of change and diversity. There's always been change and diversity, but I think it's an unprecedented extent now, and there are lots of new forms and new reasons. So far as change is concerned, the shift has been towards individual choice, away from the old top-down group conversion, where if a lord or a king of a region changed his religion, then the religion was changed by all his subjects. In the past, if there was diversity within a society, this was more likely to be related to ethnic or political or military changes in boundaries, rather than to religious changes. So we can get non-Orthodox Hungarians in Transylvania, not because they've left the Orthodox Church, but because the boundaries of Romania have been changed to encompass them. I don't want to exaggerate these terms. Most people stick to the religion in which they were brought up. And there are various qualifications that I would have to make but I still think it's a significant trend, at least in most democratic societies, towards more individual choice, and with other aspects like migration leading to a different kind of diversity, one that is achieved rather than an ascribed diversity. Now, such trends are by no means ex nihilo. There are several different features of modern society, and I'm including postmodern society, that can account for both a demand and a supply of alternative religions, which may take either a traditional or a novel form. These include globalization, individualization, relativization, mobilization, the mass media, and the World Wide Web. What I'm suggesting is that in a lot of ways, people are moving from the group definition of one's religion to the individual, but to the more networking, perhaps. But that does not mean that there aren't reactions in the opposite direction. Another important factor that affects this and is affected by it has been a weakening of traditional authority. Mike Hornsby Smith found that only 43% of Roman Catholics aged between 15 and 24 believed that under certain conditions when he speaks on matters of faith and morals, the Pope is infallible. On the other hand, 83% of the over 65s accepted papal infallibility. To grossly oversimplify, there are a whole lot of other series of processes that one might point to. Education, moving from rote learning to learning to question, to explore, to experiment, and to come up with one's own ideas, or lack of ideas in the case of grammar and punctuation. There's always been satire and a questioning of the elite, but the mass media have publicly, around the world, and privately in our own sitting rooms, undermine the authority of politicians, royalty, religious leaders, etc., to a completely unknown extent. In the 1960s, we saw that was the week that was. Today, we laugh or cry at the swinging satire of Bremner, Bird, and Fortune. The electronic media can also play an undermining of authority role, especially in situations where you've got a strong group. And there has typically been a vertical communication structure with the leadership controlling the information as it's passed down the hierarchy. I've observed in numerous groups that members can, through the internet, through chat shows and emails, exchange ideas on a horizontal networking basis and thereby undermine a whole lot of the work that is being done by the leaders and exchange information and ideas that aren't sanctioned by the leadership. These movements towards individual choice and various other things can lead to a search for a worldview or a religion that fits with our experience rather than what has been handed down to us. Think, for example, about the changes in the occupational structure. Very few of our grandparents were electronic engineers. Or think about the geographical mobility. Few of us still live in the towns and villages that our grandparents lived in. So it would be surprising if the worldview that made sense to our grandparents is going to make sense for our grandchildren. Tony said I can't talk for 2.5 hours, so I'm just trying to cut. But another thing that I do want to say is in the supply, the media do provide everybody with a sort of aperitif or a large range of ideas which they can pick up, which they couldn't have had access to in the past. And one very obvious example would be the idea of reincarnation. There's probably very few people in the West who haven't heard about it or know about the concept, whereas 100 years ago, practically nobody would. And the European Value Surveys have discovered that about 20 to 25% of Europeans and North Americans will say, yes, they believe in reincarnation, if you ask them directly that. rather than do you believe in X, Y, or Z? Because quite a few of them also believe in the resurrection of the body, which is normally thought to be incompatible, though there are ways around that. So what I'm saying is that people can dip into the cultural milieu and take odd bits that resonate with them, and they don't necessarily come up to produce some sort of system, but they're there as and when they're needed. The enormous number, Tony did sort of mention the large number of different movements that we have at Inform. Actually, there are over 1,000 new religious movements, most of which have a base in the United Kingdom. But that's only a tiny drop in the ocean. According to Barrett's two-volume World Christian Encyclopedia, there are 19 major world religions, which can be divided into a total of 270 large religious groups and many smaller ones. Of these groups, there are at least 34,000 separate Christian denominations. 34,000. No one knows how large the total number of different religious groups is, but there must be several hundreds of thousands, that's groups. Furthermore, I'd like to suggest and predict even that so long as the sort of conditions that I've briefly mentioned, including globalization, continue, then the growth of numbers of religions will continue too, unless, and this is an important unless, they are stopped with the aid of guns and or laws. And this is not impossible. There are countries, northern Nigeria or Afghanistan under the Taliban, in which the death sentence is imposed for apostasy from, in these cases, Islam, and conversion to another religion. I'd like to tell a story now that some of you have heard before, but it describes something that was a sort of Damascene consciousness raising for me. It made me aware of something I hadn't previously considered in quite the same way. It was in the mid-1980s. I was in Warsaw and had just given a lecture on religion in North America, explaining about the variety to be found there, and it was generally about pluralism. The first question that I got after I'd finished my lecture was, all those religions in one country, that's very interesting, but who's going to win? Well, I'm glad you laughed, because not everybody does if I tell that story now. I assumed that there was something wrong with the interpretation, but when I gave a similar lecture in Krakow a couple of days later, I got the same question. Who's going to win? And the concept of peaceful coexistence was, it seemed, quite alien to them. Now, this was in the time of Glasnost and Perestroika, and the Berlin Wall was still intact. So I assumed that it was something to do with the way that they had been brought up, and the struggle that was being played out in the Polish state, the solidarity and the involvement of the Catholic Church, etc. It was just after the murder of Father Popieluszko, you may remember. But I soon began to realize that the question was not one that could be forgotten. After the collapse of the USSR, the rhetoric of freedom was on the lips of all, young and old, and religious freedom was one of the freedoms most frequently articulated in the liberated societies of Central and Eastern Europe as well. But it wasn't long before the honeymoon was over. Freedom started to mean my freedom, or our freedom, not your freedom, and most certainly not their freedom. Various visits to post-communist societies later revealed a whole lot of reasons why this might be the case, and one I wondered about was the idea that Marxism, while it had been rejected, had been successful in teaching that there was one truth. And so Marxism might not be the truth. It might just be not the content, but the exclusiveness of Marxism that was making people think this way. But then, around the mid-1990s, I began to suspect that the question, who's going to win, was not only being asked in Eastern Europe, it's also being posed increasingly in parts of Western Europe and elsewhere around the world. And more particularly, this I noticed in unified Germany, and then in France and Belgium, Austria and parts of Switzerland, And now one can even see the question being asked in a more subtle form, perhaps, in places like Scandinavia and the Netherlands. And it wasn't just the question was being asked. People were doing quite a lot to try and answer it. The dominant religions or ideologies of laïcité were doing their damnedest to ensure it was they who would win, for God's sake. Who's out there in the battlefield? Who are some of the contenders in the religious scene? Well, there's secularism. But hard secularists are fairly few and thin on the ground, remarkably so. They do exist, and some of them move into their own little enclaves and see the rest of the world, which believes, as a sort of contemptuous, they put them in a kind of contemptuous them category. But they are seen as very, very frightening by an enormous amount of people, partly responsible in some ways for the rise of fundamentalism. And secular humanism, as a term, is one of considerable abuse in the United States. Soft secularists are far more common, certainly in Britain, but also elsewhere. At first sight, they'd seem to be the people who aren't just bothered about religion one way or the other. And to some extent, this is undoubtedly true about many of them much of the time. These are people who would be categorized as part of the secularizing tendency insofar as they don't attend church, for a start. And let us look at some statistics now. The figures here vary. They're mostly taken from the RAMP project that was mentioned. But say about 90% of people don't attend a place of worship. That does not necessarily mean that they are secular. If we ask people whether they're a member of a religion, then we will find that 45% say no, they're not, and 26% say they are a member of a religious group. But I managed to squeeze, I was only allowed to do it for Britain because nobody else would think it was an important question. Even if you're not a member of a religious group formally, do you consider yourself as belonging to something? Do you feel you belong? And more people, 29%, fell into this category than into the formal membership category. Then it's quite interesting if you look at God and the kind of God in which people believe. 43% believe in a personal God and 16% in an impersonal spirit or life force. But 38% believe in God as something within each person rather than out there. 9% don't believe in anything and 16% don't know what to think. Now, I wanted to go a bit further, and again I got into trouble with my colleagues in RAMP by saying I wanted to explore spirituality. They said that was a silly word, it was too woolly and you couldn't translate it, and you wouldn't understand what was meant even when it was translated. And they were right. But they did allow me to put in the question if I would draw up some sort of ideal, typical model of what it was I was looking for. So this is what I had been feeling from my qualitative research. They said I spent too much time with weirdos. I told them they spent too much time with their VDUs. But anyway, I won this one, and if I could ask the question. I'll just go through this very, very quickly. This is gross exaggeration, but it's just to try and show the drift, or one of the drifts that I think is happening quite a lot. Moving from seeing the divine as transcendent to immanent within or as part of the cosmos. Time is seen differently, with the religious of the book kind of religion. It's very much temporal and historical. There was a past and there's a present and there's going to be a particular future. Whereas spirituality is far more ahistorical and cyclical. Organization for religiosity is a vertical hierarchy compared to the horizontal network. Relations differ in that there's more control with religiosity. social identity is more group-oriented as opposed to individual-oriented. It's more dichotomous, them, us, and complementary, us. And them is those that see the dichotomy between them and us. But this is more of a yin-yang kind of perspective. The religion says that there was a creation. The spirituality people are more likely to see continual creation. Knowledge depends on dogma and revelation, scriptural authority, as opposed to experience and understanding or looking at oneself, or perhaps using mystical methods. Control is external as opposed to internal responsibility. Sex division is very much male-dominated, and sharp division between the two, where there's more female-dominated and masculinity. Life after death is salvation and resurrection as opposed to reincarnation, transmigration, and mosca. Now, there's lots of overlap. I don't want to be taken for doing anything except trying to present a general sort of picture of what it was I was looking for. The question was, and we'd already asked the question, whether or not you go to a church or a place of worship, to what extent would you say you're religious? And then the next one that they let me put in eventually was, whether you think of yourself as religious or not, would you say you have a spiritual life, something that goes beyond just an intellectual or emotional life? And the interesting figure is this. This 13% of people who will say they are not religious but are spiritual. Now, I haven't got time to go into all the things that I or Sally Stairs, my research assistant, has brilliantly worked out about this. But the point is, these are people who would be categorized normally as secular. They don't come up on a whole lot of other questions. And something's going on there. It's very difficult to pin it down. It isn't organized. These are not belongers. They do, however, lead social lives. They join up together with each other quite a lot. But it isn't a formal organization. But I think if you had to decide whether they were religious or secular and made that distinction, then whether they like being called religious or not, and they don't, they would fit into the religious rather than the secular kind. Now, if we move to the opposite spectrum, we come to what's probably the most talked about category in the religious scene, and that's the one that's labelled fundamentalist. As you doubtless know, the term fundamentalism was first applied to Protestants around the turn of the 19th century. They were concerned about the watering down of what they saw as true Christian faith through biblical criticism, evolutionism, Roman Catholicism, secular liberal thought. And they wanted to assert the fundamental tenets of their faith, the sine qua non of the Christian gospel. And these were things like the inerrancy of the Bible, the deity of Jesus, who was born of a virgin, Jesus died for our sins, that he was born of the virgin, that his body rose on the third day from the dead, and that he's going to return in the second coming. Now, more recently, the term has been applied to followers of Islam and others who hold tenets of their faith are indispensable and must be adhered to. And it's been extended not just from orthodoxy, but also to orthopraxis. And it's sometimes very difficult to distinguish between fundamentalist, orthodox, and conservative beliefs. But that's not of concern at the moment. The thing that I do want to say, and that I think is quite difficult, has created a whole lot of difficult situations, is that fundamentalism has now come to include, by definition also, a fanatic and aggressive behavior. Now, I think it loses its usefulness once it's used in this way and becomes little more than a term of abuse almost. We're no longer able to investigate whether there is any connection between firm beliefs in selected fundamental truths, because this has been assumed in the definition. It is perfectly true that those with strong beliefs may embrace a fanaticism that demands they're attacking others who don't share their beliefs. But there's no necessary reason, no theologic or any sociologic, that this is a necessary connection. And indeed, there's plenty of empirical evidence to suggest that it is not the case in very many instances. Britain, incidentally, has very few fundamentalists. 8% of those who were asked about various perspectives on the Bible, only 8% said that it should be taken as literally true. There are far, far more in the United States of America, where nearly half believe that the world was created as in Genesis and other fundamental tenets. One of the most fascinating phenomena for a sociologist of religion in recent years, or at least for this sociologist of religion, has been, as I've already intimated perhaps, the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the former Soviet Union. Generations had been subjected to state-imposed secularism, and then almost overnight they were free to follow whatever religion they wanted. Is this a case of desecularization and perhaps resecularization? There are lots of differences that are going on, but as I've already suggested, since the mid-1990s, the posing of the question who's going to win has become increasingly important, and new constitutions and new laws are being passed not to enable religious freedom, but to curtail the freedom of non-state religions, be these the Orthodox churches of Belarus, Russia, Georgia, or Armenia, or the Muslim states of Central Asia. One of the responses to these great upheavals has been a reemergence of nationalism, and religious boundaries play an important role here. Returning home one evening, my Yerevan landlady asked me where I'd been. I told her I'd been visiting the Hare Krishna temple. She shook her head. They're not Armenians, she told me. Yes, they are, I said. No, they're not. What do you mean? They've lived in Yerevan all their lives. They only speak Armenian. Their names all end in IAN. Of course they're Armenian. They're not, she insisted. They're not Christian. Come off it, I said. Your two children aren't Christian. They're atheists. Does that mean they're not Armenian? Certainly not, she retorted. They're Christian atheists. Now, this, of course, meant that they were Armenian. It gets more complicated. The them-us plays that go on in the former Soviet Union, where the mother church will define us and everybody else as them, but then other churches of increasingly lower status will define themselves as part of the us, including the mother church, and everybody else as them. And needless to say, the new religions from foreign lands are excluded from all the us's. Not that the indigenous new religions do much better. And this takes me to the final category that I want to mention, and that's that of new religious movements. It's impossible to overemphasize the diversity, the really remarkable diversity one finds among new religious movements. Each year, for I suppose about the last 20 years, I have been offering my students a box of Smarties if they can come up with one factor, characteristic, that is common to all of them, apart from the fact that they've been called a new religious movement or a cult, and I haven't had to buy a box of Smarties yet. You can always find one of their number that will contradict the generalization. However, I'm a sociologist, so I'm now going to make some generalizations. There are all these different types, and I want to stress this, that they really do differ according to their beliefs, rituals, lifestyle, organization, attitudes, etc. But just because they are new, and I'm talking about first generation movements, not movements that are new to a particular country like Hinduism here with the immigrants, just because they are new and religious, they have certain characteristics, or some of them do, quite a few of them do, which do give rise to some problems sometimes. First of all, being first generation, they are converts. Now, converts are always very enthusiastic, even fanatic in the early stages. My brother converted to Catholicism, and he was quite impossible for about 3 months. It isn't just new religions. Converts care. Secondly, they appeal to an atypical proportion of the population. Now, most of the new religions, not all of them, but a lot of them, have appealed to, and I'm talking about the present wave, not other waves, the present wave that arose since about late 60s, early 70s, appealed disproportionately to young, well-educated people. And this is a graph of the demographic distribution of members of the Children of God as they were there. And you can see that they, I haven't put in the numbers there, well, this is 10, 20. The peak here for the age is 23. Now, the thing to notice is that there are no children and no old people, or practically none. So there are no dependents. These young, healthy people can go around and do all sorts of things for God's sake. God's sake, somebody's... So that is another characteristic, the atypical appeal. Thirdly, very often there is a charismatic leader, and the charismatic leader wields charismatic power. That means he, or occasionally she, is unencumbered by things like rules or tradition. And this means that they're unaccountable to anybody except perhaps God, and unpredictable. They can have an enormous influence over all aspects of people's lives, from where they live, what sort of work they'll do, perhaps whether they'll live, and what sort of toothpaste they'll use. And they can be dangerous and manipulative. But this is a two-way process. Think of the story of the fond mother who said, Johnny is definitely a leader. The problem is that nobody will follow him. You need to have followers if you're going to work as a charismatic leader. And furthermore, it's possible to observe what I have called charismatization. I'm sorry about that, but I wanted to get process. This is a process that I and now some of my students have seen quite often in new religious movements, where the leader might be almost unknown by the followers, but the followers build up a picture through a variety of different ways about how they talk about him and give him this special authority. Fourthly, very often there is a dichotomous worldview in opposition to them. Not always, but quite often. And this is not surprising if you consider that they are new and they are alternative. There is felt a need to protect them from the outside, and this isn't just the present wave. Jesus said, if you don't hate your parents, you can't be my disciple. This is something that happens, this cutting off very often from former friends and parents. Also, there's a need to simplify, not to muddy the waters, so that it's clear what the new picture and the new beliefs are. And then fifthly, there is usually a lot of suspicion, fear, ignorance about new religious movements. They are, after all, offering an alternative, so those who like what they've already got are not going to like them very much. There are now, in various places around the world, a number of anti-cult movements, and these are groups that select all the things that they see as harmful about new religious movements. And some of them are very extreme themselves and display some of the characteristics that they say the cults have. There's also a counter-cult movement, and they, instead of selecting the bad aspects, are more likely to select what's wrong from a theological point of view. I want to finish up now talking about some of the ways in which not the new religions defining themselves, but us defining them. And first and most obviously, perhaps, there is the very use of the word cult. A cult is used in a technical sense in the sociology of religion, but when it's used in the popular sense, it means something like this. Cults, an evil satanic and financial racket that uses irresistible and irreversible brainwashing techniques to exploit its recruits. It abuses children, is involved in violence and political intrigue, and its members are likely to commit mass suicide. Religion, on the other hand, is good and godly. Now, as good social scientists, of course, we want to ask, it's gone blurry, we want to ask, is this the case? It may well be true that a particular new religious movement is involved in financial rackets or child abuse or violence or what have you. But unless we define it separately, we can't know. But that first picture is fairly common. And if you go to dinner parties at Hampstead, as I sometimes do, you will be told all this very seriously over the first course if you admit what you do for a living. As I've already been intimating, definitions and boundaries can be used in a number of ways to include and exclude. But it's very often those that are nearest which are seen as the greatest a threat, rather than something that's literally beyond the pale. This is something that Mary Douglas also has pointed out quite clearly. It's the Christian evangelicals who are most concerned about those new religions, such as unificationism or the family, that share a lot of their beliefs, rather than a movement like ISKCON, the International Society of Consciousness, which is no direct threat to their identity or their permissible boundary of true Christianity. Beliefs, I've already suggested at the beginning when talking about methodological agnosticism that there's no independent way of assessing beliefs about the supernatural. And this indeterminacy is compounded by the fact that most sources of revelation are open to a number of possible interpretations. Most of the commandments are negated at some point or other in the Bible if you look hard enough and use a particular form of interpretation. Yet the Jehovah's Witnesses in Russia have been facing liquidation, and experts have been called in court stating that they are giving the wrong interpretation of the Bible. In Britain, in the Daily Mail case with the Unificationists, the judge suggested that, and I quote, "No reasonable man could believe that Sun Myung Moon was the Messiah, and the jury had, therefore, to decide whether the appellant was either a dupe or a fraud." I've already talked about taken-for-granted way of life and how we think that our way is natural and others are abnormal or unnatural. Now, this has led to medicalization of people in new religious movements or belonging to some other faith. They've been hospitalized despite the fact that they have no clear clinical symptoms. I'm not saying that some people in new religions don't go mad. Some of them are mad and ought to be in hospital. But just because of their beliefs, they have been hospitalized. And conservatorship orders have been taken out on the statement that they must be incompetent because of their beliefs. Much of this rests on the assumption of brainwashing. Brainwashing has been and continues to be, of course, nothing more than a metaphor. No one has ever taken out a brain and washed it. Nonetheless, it is thought that because people believe such things, something strange must have happened. In my study in the 1970s, where hundreds were being kidnapped out of their religion, not necessarily a new religion, by anxious parents who persuaded they'd never see their son or daughter, adult son or daughter, if they didn't hand over thousands of pounds or dollars to deprogrammers. I looked at the unification careers of over 1,000 people, and 90% didn't join when they went to what is known as an irresistible and irreversible workshop. The process just didn't work. And furthermore, although that means that it was probably something about the individual, I found, using control groups, that the individuals weren't particularly pathetic. Now, of course, lots of the new religious movements would like to brainwash, and they certainly try to influence people, but they're not nearly as successful as traditional religions. I'm suggesting that it is the content of the beliefs, not the process by which they come to them, that is being attacked. Other ways of incriminating new religions and old religions is to lump them together. The sins of one are visited on the sins of all. Then there's guilt by association. If you read anything about a new religion in the paper, you'll also find out about Waco, the Solar Temple, Jonestown, etc., whether it's relevant or not. The media select what's sexy, novel, and bizarre, never the normal and ordinary. That's just not news. They don't take account of change. Those characteristics that I told you about obviously change over time. The demographic ones, children come about, the young converts become older, and charismatic leaders die. Some of them say they're not going to, but they usually do. Then there's a sort of general accommodation that goes on as time passes. Very often one gets the impression, if one sees a headline saying something like, cult member commits suicide, and you see this several times, this can be perfectly true, but after a few times you begin to think, well, what is it about cults that makes people commit suicide? However, if you were to do a user control group of people of roughly the same age and social background, you might well find that people in the cult commit less suicide than those of their peers. There may be other reasons for that, but at least the question might be asked, what is it about the new religious movement that stops people committing suicide? And it isn't just name-calling by the media, the anti-cultists, etc. Lots of things are happening at government level as well. Distinctions are being created. Registration in various countries depends on the number of members that there are and the length of time they've been about. This obviously discriminates against those movements which are new. There have been a number of reports, government reports, about sects or cults in which they have been criminalized. They are called, by definition, criminals. And lists have been produced in France and in Belgium by these reports of, in the case of France, 172, in Belgium, 184, different groups, including Quakers, and the YWCA, not the YMCA for some reason. These lists have given permission to people to do all sorts of things, to make people lose their jobs if they're on the list. Children aren't allowed to go to school, and they're not allowed to join political parties. They can't rent halls or buy houses. And observatories have been set up to combat the dangerous sect. Laws have been introduced, not only ones like the 1997 law in Russia, but in France in 2001, a fairly devastating law to attack and control or combat the dangerous sects. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not saying that religion doesn't lead people to do nasty things. It does terrible things. People have done really awful things, for God's sake. And I'm as adamant as anyone that if somebody commits a criminal act, then in a democratic study they should be subject to the full thrust of the law. But I am arguing that in countries, specifically those that have signed the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights or the European Convention, we should not remove the civil rights of citizens by implying that they've done things they've not done on the grounds of their beliefs. We're using double standards, implying that their behavior is more criminal than ours, when we're doing exactly the same thing by any objective standards. To conclude, there are many commentators on the religious scene who make grand pronouncements about the way that religion is moving. The world is being taken over or totally undermined by fanatic fundamentalists, wishy-washy tree-hugging new ages, sinister cults, or secular humanists. My grand pronouncement is that contemporary religion is not moving in one direction, but in many directions. And some of these directions are more welcome than others. We may celebrate or we may fear diversity, but I believe it's here to stay. We certainly need to be alert to potential dangers, but we also need to be aware that we ourselves can contribute towards those very dangers by our reactions and prejudices. I don't know who will win. My personal feeling is that if anyone does, we shall all have lost. But I do know that who will win is a question that is important to a lot of people. And while some of the Crusades may be fought with stealth bombers, suicide bombers, or weapons of mass destruction, other more subtle battles are being found in the concepts we use and misuse for purposes of preserving, protecting, or promoting our gods, while distancing, diminishing, and or denouncing theirs. I've touched on some of the things that are done by people like us, who are not spectacularly good or evil. And sometimes we do it through bigotry, but quite often through ignorance, thoughtlessness, carelessness, or just pure laziness. I readily concede that having to observe a political correctness all the time has become a bore and even counterproductive. But perhaps just a bit more understanding and consciousness raising about the diverse forms of religion in everyday life and the concepts that we and they use would not go amiss. And I believe the sociology of religion could have a role to play in doing just that, even if it's not for God's sake, but for that of our fellow human beings.
Sorry. Well, we got, I think, about a quarter of an hour for questions, if people should choose to ask them. I think there are roving mics going around downstairs and upstairs, so whoever wants to ask a question, perhaps would you wait until the microphone reaches you? Maybe just one question per person would be good.
Hello, yes. I was just wondering what you thought of the census result of 70% of us are Christian.
What I thought about it? Well, I wasn't particularly surprised. I mean, I don't quite understand the question. Do I think you're not really Christians, you 70%? Or what is real Christianity? You tell me what...
figures that you gave before?
Well, the thing is, it's a mess. I mean, what I was trying to say was, it is a mess. People say apparently contradictory things, but I don't think apparently contradictory is contradictory in the world that we live in, or that people are that systematic and clear. In fact, probably the only systematic people are members of new religious movements who get far more messy and have more qualifications and contradictions as time goes on, and they become a bit more like the rest of us.
It's giving solace to bishops anyway at the moment.
Well, someone in the middle there holding up a paper for ages and therefore very keen to ask a question.
I noticed during your talk, most of your humorous comments or sideswipes were directed towards the Christian faith. You used humorous drawings with strong Christian imagery. You made fun of the Virgin Mary and the resurrection. It seemed interesting that you make no such jokes in relation to Islam. Is it because you're frightened that you might offend somebody? And if you are, then why were you not take a little bit more care about offending Christians who might be in the audience?
Well, I'm very sorry if I offended the Christians in the audience. I certainly didn't mean to. And the reason why I focused more on religion, on Christianity, than on Islam, is because I know more about it.
Maybe take the mic, because not everyone can hear you in the room, especially upstairs.
it's quite apparent that you don't know as much as you think. Otherwise, you would have realised that you were likely to offend people by some of your comments.
Well, I apologise. I can't do any more than that.
Please, is anyone upstairs? Oh, yes, there are a few people. Do you want to pick someone from upstairs?
Oh, you do the picking.
Or someone of that size on there. Let's take one from upstairs first, Joe. There are quite a few actually waving their hands up there.
When you were talking about brainwashing and things, you made some references, which made me wonder what you think of alpha groups and the way that people are conditioned by such things. I speak as one Christian who is definitely not offended by your jokes.
I don't want to offend anybody talking about alpha groups. I think they just sort of fall into the general category of evangelical Christianity, and at Holy Trinity Brompton, etc., these are people who have found a way to experience and celebrate their Christian faith. It's not the way you or I might want to do it, but I wouldn't call it brainwashing. And I know a lot of people who have got a lot out of the alpha groups. I'm a value-free objective social scientist.
Let's have another question at the top there.
I'm stupid enough to make jokes.
I must say there was something to be learned from the last question, which was exemplary use of the microphone. If you hold the mic fairly near your face, but not right in your face, that everyone can hear really well.
Yes, Is that okay? Yeah. You spoke about government enforcement of the views of certain religious groups. Now, in Britain, this has been long established Christianity with an Anglican tinge, but it's been increasingly invaded by Catholics over the last 30 or 40 years. The Home Office, for instance, can use quite draconian methods, hand in hand with the psychiatric establishment, to try to use brainwashing techniques and quite violent and law-breaking techniques in a fairly clandestine manner. For instance, there's a group called the Police Catholic Guild, which takes upon itself to try and organise certain family relations with certain categories of offender by force, effectively, by gangsterism. Now, I don't know if you're aware of this, and it sounds an extreme claim that I'm making. In fact, it may sound lunatic saying this, but are you aware of this? And if not, I think it should bring to your attention.
Thank you. No, I wasn't. And I don't believe there are such things as brainwashing techniques.
Not at all.
I mean,
there was all this interrogation and stuff in Sargent's Battle for the Mind, you know, about...
Yeah, I know about that.
Forced interrogation.
Yeah, well, I think this could be a very long discussion about brainwashing techniques, but I think you've got to be very careful. There are a lot of techniques which put a lot of pressure on people, and sometimes we might consider that undue pressure, and I'd have said locking them up for a start or using drugs for a seconders would be undue pressure. We're all influenced the whole time. That's in fact what the School of Social Science is about, looking at the ways in which we interact, influence each other, and are influenced by something we call society. And I think just sort of saying brainwashing techniques is a dangerous and confusing and not very helpful way of describing somebody's behaviour. But I don't know the particular case that you're talking about with these Catholics. What? Torture. Yeah, well, I wouldn't call that brainwashing. I'd call that torture.
I think that's fair enough. There are a couple of questions from downstairs we could have. We have to draw to a close fairly soon, I'm afraid, in spite of the evident level of interest in the audience in interrogating you.
From your studies, do you have a feeling to what extent the Russian Orthodox Church is being used by ordinary Russians as a form of nationalism because they lost the empire, rather than a genuine belief, if you see what I mean?
Oh, dear. what is a genuine belief? I mean, Orthodox belief is very different from Baptist belief or Anglican belief, and there are lots of different kinds. For some people, I mean, Orthodoxy is not, for most people, a theological belief. You go and you light candles and you listen to that fantastic, beautiful music in lovely surroundings, and something happens. Now, the Orthodox Church has, of course, been the vessel of culture for ages. And during the Militsi's time, the Orthodox churches had very important political roles. They stand for something in the past, whether they really did everything that they claim and that their believers or their members might believe they do or not is another question. But I think it is something that is symbolically incredibly important to the Russian people. But that doesn't mean to say they have to believe in God or the fundamentals. When I was doing some research in Armenia, I tried to write a questionnaire, and I was asking about how many of the four Gospels could be named. And nobody could tell me what the four Gospels were when I was asking them about, you know, how to translate the words. And the first person I found who could actually name three of them was the head of the Communist Party. Now, it's a different sort of thing. So talking about belief, yes, they believe in their nationalism. And all right, I told that story about my landlady because I wanted to give that importance about the sort of role it can make. But I think it's a mistake if we think of religion, any religion, as just belief. But dogma and belief is far more important in certain religions than it is in others. But that doesn't mean to say it's less religious, unless you define religion in that way.
I think we've only got time for two more questions, given the logistics of the evening. So take one from here and one from up the top there. I apologize to others who might have wanted to intervene.
I want to thank you for being provocative, and as well as for your tour d'horizon. But my question is really about the internet and how you think that has affected the cult, anti-cult battle, and who's winning that one.
it has made quite a lot of difference. Everybody has their own website. There are battles to get onto a top high place on the search engines. A lot of times, if you're looking for a particular group, you'll get a whole lot of anti-cult sites before you can get to the group's own site. There are all sorts of difficulties with what goes on the internet because there are so many lies that are told. And I speak about some of the things that are said about me. Please don't go and look them all up, because they're not true. But it's far worse, of course, for a lot of other people. There's no control. It's very, very difficult. So there's this great mess out there, and it's almost luck what you plug into and what you'll be told. So I think it's very dangerous in that sense. The lack of control, because it's into the World Wide Web. The lawyers haven't been able to do very much about this. A lot of them have tried, but then if you start to sue somebody at one site using one facility, they'll just pop over to whatever country they can, where they can't be controlled, and the same thing will happen. Plus people saying, oh, you're trying to suppress freedom of speech, etc. But it does provide a lot of fun. It certainly provides my students with a bibliography that's not always exactly what I would want them to read. But it's a big challenge.
We take one last question, I'm afraid, from at the back there. And I do apologize to all the others who wanted to ask questions.
It's my fault because I talked too long.
Thank you. With all the research you've done, do you see a means to solve...
Microphone closer.
Sorry. With all the research you've done, do you see a means to solving conflicts in such regions as, for example, Nagorno-Karabakh or Bosnia? or perhaps through education, integration, assimilation, mass population transfers, or will religious beliefs always inevitably drive humanity to genocide?
No. I mean, I think there are lots of things we can do just to try and understand and get rid of some of the rubbish that is talked. I think there should be more meeting between people. I mean, there was a whole lot of ethnic cleansing that went on in Nagorno-Karabakh after what happened in Azerbaijan. You know, it's you can see when you go to these places the intensity growing as the process has become worse and worse, and there are some ways in which one can reduce some of them. I can't possibly go into all this at the moment. But I think trying to break down some of these conceptual barriers and stop some of this dehumanizing of them that goes on and that we do. I mean, I do it. I think all of us do it to some extent or the other. And it's very difficult not to. But I haven't got a simple answer, I'm afraid. I wish I had. No. That's because I don't think...
Sorry, shan't announce.
I think not.
Okay.
Nick will kill you if you don't.
I would say there are three tests of a good lecture. You get the punters in, you get the room full, you make people laugh a bit with you, not at you, and you have far more questions stored up than you can possibly answer. And I would say, according to these three tests, Eileen passed with flying colours, so please give her a big clap to thank her for coming here tonight.
I didn't know who to thank the organizer.